Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I am your host for this episode, Dr. Mark Dubin from Baltimore, Maryland. Today, we will be discussing the collaborative effort of what looks to be about 450 authors, International Consensus Statement on Allergy and Rhinology, Sinonasal Tumors, or in short, ICAR Sinonasal Tumors 2024, which was published in February of 2024. I'm joined today by Dr. Edward Kwan, the first author from the University of California in Irvine, California, and Dr. Jim Palmer, the senior author from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Welcome, Ed and Jim, and congratulations to you and your co-authors on this publication.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mark.
Thanks, guys. I'll start by saying in full disclosure that I did not read the entire 400 plus pages of this document, which is more akin to a textbook than a manuscript. With that said, my goal is distilling this tome into salient take-home points that would interest both the average practicing otolaryngologist who less often sees sinonasal tumors, as well as an academic endoscopic skull-based surgeon who makes a living off of them. So let's start the conversation. Why this topic and why now? And how does this differ from that's been published previously?
Yeah, I think it's a really great point to start with, Mark. So the ARS has made a very strong effort over time to create all these outstanding ICAR documents, which are really large syntheses of the literature. There wasn't really a specific home after all these years for sinonasal tumors. And with growing interest in the field, as you kind of see at conferences, you see with more publications over time, people talking more about this in a dedicated panel session, we've thus embarked on this undertaking to try to synthesize all of this so that there's almost like a one-stop shop for readership.
So with that, obviously this is a massive document. Can you tell me what are the logistics of making this happen? How does this come to be?
Yeah, it's quite a major undertaking. So I think it follows the same protocol for all of the other ICAR studies in the past. So what we do is we follow the example of how they put it together. We have a steering editorial committee that is developed. We then propose a list of topics to be included within the document itself. This is then sent up to the IFAR editor-in-chief and the leadership. We then invite the authors based on contributions, publications, and reputation in management of sinonasal tumors. And they, in turn, are able to select collaborators to formulate the team for assessing each topic. Each team then performed a systematic review of the topic based on PRISMA guidelines, and they turned that in for editorial team review just to make sure we're all on the same page. And then following approval, they then proceeded with drafting each session. And then after consensus was achieved with all sections, the whole document was reviewed, formatted, synthesized. And of course, the document actually went through a pretty big revamping to make sure that the WHO fifth edition classification was used for nomenclature.
Great.
Or another way to say it, Mark, from my perspective, is we handed Ed Kwan the ball, and every one of us just acted like blockers. And there were six people who were the associate editors of sort of the offensive line. And I got to be the quarterback and hand the ball, and we watched him run it all the way to the end zone.
Yeah, it's an amazing assembly of data. I mean, this is the part where I normally say, well, can you describe the methods? But that understates the amount of work and effort that you put in. I mean, how do you reach consensus on these statements? I mean, I know a lot of these people, I see them on panels. You know, consensus is not something that is necessarily easily achievable amongst our colleagues.
Yeah, consensus is, for the different ICAR documents, has different approaches to it. So we actually followed the example set by ICSB, or ICAR Skull-Based Surgery, from 2019, led by Eric Wong, who's also one of our associate editors for this project. We had two associate editors review each session, followed by myself and then Jim. So then we actually have four people separately review it. All of these changes go back and forth with the author team that ended up submitting the session, and then they were vetted at the end. And everyone had to agree with all of the changes in order to proceed to the final stage of the project, which is to assemble and then have a four-week review period to all authors in order to see if there's any last-minute changes. And of course, at every single stage, you're going to have a couple of changes, a couple of updates, but for the most part, it was pretty smooth, fortunately, to be able to achieve consensus for each section.
And remarkably collegial. And I guess I would say, you know, again, I'm going to keep giving kudos to Ed for being such the day-to-day leader of this thing. But I also want to say that as a group, all of us had the same goal, which is to get the best data, the best thoughts down. And that's what a consensus is, so that we could all take care of our patients better. So it really, in the group effort, everyone had the same goal. So unlike panels where sometimes people start fighting, I was remarkably impressed at how everyone was working together for the same end goal.
That's great. When did this start? How long has this been in the works?
So we actually conceived of the 2021, our first quarter, and that's when we met as a steering editorial committee. And then the vetting process was actually fairly smooth, probably during summertime. And then all of the invitations for writing and contributions went out about fall. And then the actual getting the sections, reviewing took about 2 years. And then at the end, there was a couple months period just to synthesize it into a one voice document. So I would call it about a two and a half year.
I continue to say, but it's an impressive document. All right, so let's dive into the meat of it a little bit. From a 30,000 kind of foot view, are there any specific challenges or controversies, advancements, et cetera, that you think that you'd like to call out as first author that justify special comment in this document?
Yeah, I think the one thing that really stuck out to me when I was putting this together with everybody, who, by the way, I want to definitely give a shout out to the editorial team, without whom this work would not be possible. So in addition to Jim, who's definitely just been the most amazing mentor, we have Nathan Adapa, Dan Beswick, Niall London, Shirley Sue, Eric Wong, and Marilyn Wong, who are all the editorial team members. So, and of course, all the authors who put in countless hours to put it together. And when we went through this, the one thing that really stuck out was that the evidence level was really low in this field. So it's really based on a lot of experiences and anecdotes. So there's a lot of opportunity and there's a lot of room for improvement in not only the clinical care, but also the research and the basis of understanding. So one thing that we found was when we looked at literature for tumors that are largely treated non-surgically, it's driven by our medical and radiation oncology colleagues. The level of evidence in those fields is frankly outstanding. They have clinical trials, they have basic science studies, they have very, very detailed, well-designed things. So there's a lot to be learned from our colleagues. And I think this collaboration and research, in addition to patient care, is really going to be the key thing to drive this field forward.
So from the other angle, are there any big misconceptions that you learned in training that, you know, about tumor management that you clearly noted that were false or should be changed just for everybody who sees these patients?
Yeah. Fortunately, not a lot of major misconceptions. I think most of us are on the same page when it comes to the general concepts that really make the biggest difference. It is worth mentioning that the field has been moving forward with several paradigm shifts that have further refined our ability to take care of these patients. So for instance, we've pushed the definition of resectability. Previously, pterygopalatine and infratemporal fossa tumors, especially malignancies, have been considered largely unresectable, but now it's deemed to be quite feasible with a lot of newer studies. Things like orbital tumors or tumors invading the orbit, they can be treated effectively, not only with surgery. We're talking outside of exoneration. We have partial orbitotomy as a possible treatment, or even non-surgical means like induction chemotherapy to debulk and kind of reduce the locally advanced disease, depending on the situation. And then there's also now a role for surgery for nasopharyngeal carcinoma. Okay, that's also a shift in thinking based on a lot of literature pushed by our Asian colleagues. And it may be acceptable to not achieve negative margins for things like adenoid cystic carcinoma in the right situation. So there's a lot of different things that are listed in the document that are these nuances from original understanding.
Jim, so you're a lot older than both of us. So, you know, when you trained in the dark ages, is there anything that you want to point out that's different?
Well, it's nice of you to point out my seniority there, Mark. But I guess, it's funny. I agree with everything Ed laid out. the bottom line for us is tumor out, and then you've got so many options for other treatments. And so the things that I really come back to on the change that have been made is that when I started my career, for example, malignant melanoma was dismal to the point that if there was any even significant amount of surgery, you almost shrugged your shoulders and said, you can start with hospice if you want. Now, we can, especially with our endoscopic techniques, get that tumor out. And then we've got so many new targeted therapies. These patients are living for 3 and 4 years as opposed to 3 and 4 months. So that would be another one that I would think about. And I guess what this really puts together for me is there is a paradigm shift in hope for these patients. And it's also pretty clear that this group putting this together marks down the end of the fight, endoscopic versus open. And the reality is surgeon-related, get the best surgical resection that you can get, which in so many cases is going to be endoscopic because of the less morbidity, and then on with all the other adjuvant treatments that we can do.
That's great. So shift gears a little bit. So for the non-endoscopic skull-based surgeon who's both reading this or having it sit on their shelf as for future reference, and who's listening to this, when a patient presents with something concerning for a sinonasal tumor, can you talk about the synthesis of the recommendations for evaluation, workup, biopsy, et cetera? What questions should we be asking? What should everyone be doing, not doing, you know, et cetera?
I think it's important to screen for risk factors and understand where possible risk factors come from. It's actually more for counseling. You know, some things are occupational, for example, and so it'd be good to see if any of them can be modified. The next step, obviously, is considering imaging and biopsy just to understand the identity of the lesion. So biopsy, of course, is a key work part of the workup. There's very little dedicated evidence for biopsy techniques and setting, but proper planning generally makes it very safe to be done in clinic, although it's also equally correct to perform it under anesthesia so that you can comprehensively evaluate the sites of attack, the sites of attachment, as well as the texture of the tumor, which really tells you about how you're going to tackle it surgically later if that's going to be an option. Imaging studies, of course, formulate the basis of not only local extent and metastatic workup, and then CT and MRI really are a great place to start with complementary information of the primary tumor. PET scans, of course, will help with detecting and following regional and distant disease. That's kind of the short version of what to consider when you have a patient like this in the office.
Awesome. So invertebrate papilloma, I'm going to go and, you know, I want to make special note of, because I think that's something that obviously is the most common, you know, benign tumors that we all see. And I think it's important for everyone to know what this document says. So, you know, talk to me a little bit about the workup, you know, the treatment of the attachment, post-surgical management, follow-up, et cetera.
So we did classify papillomas into its own chapter or section, and inverted papillomas really takes the cake on the meat of that entire section just because of how important it is to most of our practices. So the key takeaway, I would say, is working with pathology to confirm the diagnosis and understand the degree of dysplasia, which really has a prognostic value in terms of malignant transformation risk as well as recurrent risk. Preoperative imaging is going to be helpful to address any sites of hyperostosis, understand where they are, which might suggest to you where's the predominant site of attachment. We really have to get there. Treatment of all sites of attachment is comprehensive, and using a combination of resecting it, drilling it, gentle cautery, depending on where it's located, even if it's on the orbit and the skull base, actually is, can be done very safely. And then radiation therapy has really been talked about as an option for patients, but really are for poor surgical candidates, patients with malignancy found in the sample, multiply recurrent or unresectable lesions. So surgery still remains the mainstay. And then one big thing that I think the literature has really showcased to us recently is that IPs probably should be surveillance long-term, even beyond 5 years, because a lot of times you'll actually detect them really late in terms of recurrence. It doesn't behave like the traditional paradigm of a 5 years and then low likelihood of recurrence. It's actually potentially going to regrow at a different point. So that's something I think has really been emphasized in our document, as well as some of the new literature coming out. Jim, you've got IP opinions. Anything to add?
No, I think you covered it beautifully, Ed. You know, obviously, I guess the thing that we want to emphasize on the IP portion is, number one, treatment is surgical, surgical, surgical. And then number two, follow-up lifelong. And those are the two things that I would really point out. And so for someone that's in practice that says, hey, I'm going to go after this IP, I think that's wonderful if you do a good job, but you're also signing yourself up for a lifetime of surveillance. And if you're not ready for that, then you probably ought to pass that on to someone that is thinking in those terms. These are not one and done type of treatments.
Thanks. That's great. And I mean, all kidding aside, Jim's not that much older than me. So, I mean, I remember, you know, during my very brief academic tenure, being called out by my head and neck colleagues that, you know, resecting IP endoscopically was malpractice. And to see how far we've come. Anyone listening to this who wants to grab me at a conference, I'll tell you who that was. But it's amazing to me how far we've come, you know, with all of this, you know. So shifting gears to kind of the flip of, you know, papilloma, squamous cell carcinoma. So also obviously the most common malignant tumor we see in the nose. So what are some of the important considerations you guys synthesized that were presented that were not in the ICSB document in 2019?
Yeah, so what we try to do, and with the icarcinonasal tumors, what we try to do is have a complementary presentation of some of the information from what was already well summarized in ICSB. So we expanded the management section for sinonasal squamous cell carcinomas and incorporated mainly non-surgical treatment strategies. So in short, surgery still remains the primary modality for squamous cell carcinoma, and adjuvant radiation is commonly utilized for high-grade tumors and locally advanced disease. So what we also covered then is induction chemotherapy and its growing role in treating these tumors. They can be considered for locally advanced disease, especially those involving the orbit and the skull base, which can have a role in organ preservation. And then definitive chemoradiation is often utilized as a treatment only for those patients who are poor surgical candidates or in some types of early stage small disease, if patients really elect that. And then we also talk about elective management of the N0 neck, which is an option for advanced stage tumor, especially maxillary sinus primary. So those are kind of the new additions in addition to what ICSB has covered, which is the role of surgical treatment, especially endoscopic surgery for squamous cell carcinoma, which still I think is the mainstay.
Great. So we talked about some of the other histopathologies, but are there anything of any of the other histopathologies that are worthy of note for the podcast? The answer does not have to be yes.
Yeah, just a couple of points. I think some of the newer literature, and we synthesized it into a document in order to really push these new points. The first one is there's a paradigm shift in treatment of sinonasal and differentiated carcinoma, or SNUC, to utilize upfront induction chemotherapy as a way to select out how to later treat them, either surgically or with definitive chemoradiation. Adenoid-cystic carcinoma, the role of gross total resection versus trying to always chase the negative margins. I think there's been some good literature on that that's been covered in the document. Jim mentioned immunotherapy in the setting of mucosal melanoma, which is originally given an option at the time of the preparation of the document, but really now has shifted to a much greater scale of use. So that is probably going to change. Everything published immediately becomes obsolete, of course. And then the emerging importance of Hyams grading on prognostication for olfactory neuroblastomas, I think, is a huge thing that's recently been exciting for us. And then finally, the poor evidence in adult rhabdomyosarcoma, with much of it being abstracted from the pediatric rhabdomyosarcoma literature. I think those are key highlights of other histopathologies worth mentioning.
Awesome. So I do want to ask about what the recommendations are for follow-up, because I think it's important for all these patients, because I think it's not uncommon, particularly for those of us who practice in non-academic settings, who send these in, that they tend to sneak back out into our worlds and kind of get lost to follow up in the academic world, whether it's distance or some of the logistical challenges. So I think it's worth noting, you know, what the recommendations are for treatment follow-up, if you wouldn't mind commenting on that.
Of course. So many patients can present with recurrent disease and they wouldn't know that they have it. So I think a key point is partnering with them in order to help them through the process, because they need to understand that that is always a risk. That can only be picked up on a regimen of endoscopy and imaging and just having that clinical suspicion. When they do present with new symptoms after treatment, it may portend that the disease is already pretty advanced, just because it's sizable enough to be able to lead to some of the mass effects and invasive effects of some of these tumors. So multimodal assessments, so a regimen of history and exam, endoscopy, imaging, particularly MRI and PET, become very important because you're able to pick up early presentations of recurrence. Most of the time, we do still follow the NCCN guidelines for surveillance, where you choose an interval that grows longer as patients are further out. However, some specific tumors, and we talked about this earlier as well, inverted papilloma, olfactory neuroblastoma, and then adenoid cystic carcinoma, these have a propensity for late recurrence. And it doesn't even have to be local recurrence. It can be distant recurrence or distant metastasis without even initial or recurrent presentation in the local disease area. And so lifelong surveillance for these patients should really be considered. I think that's the key message from, we have a dedicated section on surveillance that we really have to tailor based on the wishes of the patient, but having them understand. And then for some of these tumors, they really require lifelong surveillance.
So Mark, Ed covers things so completely and beautifully. And as you know, I'm a little more of a simple thinker. So the message I want to get home to the podcast crew that's listening is, number one, these people deserve endoscopic evaluation forever. Number two, MRI and endoscopy are complementary, not exclusion of each other, because there'll be times when you find a tumor on the mucosa and it didn't show up on the MRI, and there'll be times when tumor is deep and you don't see it on endoscopy. And the last point is, as much as I really like and quote the NCCI guidelines on a lot of things, they're so based on, you have to have some sort of symptom to have you start looking and doing surveillance. And so many of these people, as Ed brought out at the beginning, don't have much in the way of symptoms at the early recurrence. And that's exactly when we can treat them and have them do better. So not that I want this to be in concrete stone or however you want to say it, but I think about these tumors that they show up in my office after treatment, every 3 months for the first year, and then every year forever after five, and in between that, years 2, 3, 4, and 5. Actually, it's to some extent, I'm that patient choose, right? Because if they want to come see me every 3 months for an endoscopic evaluation, I got room to check them and make sure everything's okay. Is that overkill? Maybe. But boy, if you see it, you're glad you saw it. And then you decrease that interval of recurrence time.
Great, great points, Jim. Thank you. So it's obviously important when we talk about cancer management, tumor management, we talk about quality of life as well. There's obviously a lot of literature about the improved quality of life and decreased morbidity of endoscopic approaches. We wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation. So would you mind addressing some of the patient quality of life aspects that we all should be aware of that you summarized for us in the manuscript?
Yeah, of course. So I think it's important to keep in mind, every time we offer some type of treatment modality, it will lead to some potential morbidity. And that's something that patients, of course, have to understand if they're even, you know, embarking on minimally invasive surgery, which we know we don't change the extent of resection or the extent of treatment that they would get from any other approach. So it's important to understand and counsel patients on these sequela. The expectation for them is that short-term worsening of quality of life after any form of treatment or following different combinations of treatment is pretty much guaranteed. But in many cases, as they heal, it will get them back up to almost close to baseline quality of life. Much of the literature actually does report that it goes to baseline, but I do think it depends on how much and what type of tumor, the, your radiation field, whether they get chemo or not, all of those things are going to factor in. Radiation tends to lead to local side effects, both acute and late, and then chemotherapy, lots of systemic sequela with about severe adverse events in up to about half patients. So those are expectations. And then benign lesions tend to have a better baseline quality of life than malignant lesions, and therefore has a better chance of returning to baseline as well. Lots of great literature coming out on this. There is no set standard for how to assess quality of life specifically inside the nasal tumors. There's been a lot of different instruments used. We also do cover that specifically so that there's different, panels of instruments that if you want to have any provider take a look at and use to their choosing, that's all in there as well.
Thanks. That's great. So you mentioned earlier how good the literature is with our MedOnc and RadOnc colleagues, in contrast to some of our literature, acknowledging our field of endoscopic tumor surgeries, obviously much younger. Are there any areas that we should focus on for research that would have a disproportionate impact on the management of this disease state?
Jim, in terms of big picture?
Big picture. What does this tell us we want to do? I think number one, this tells us we want to start banking all our tumors some way or another so we can get genetic profiles, so we can identify what the future is in terms of chemotherapy, which ones are radiosensitive, which ones aren't. And then, really, in some ways, sinonasal carcinoma of all these different types is almost an orphan disease. It happens so rarely. And if we can start collecting tumors and trying to get them banked, get them sequenced, we can start to really increase our ability to take care of these people and know exactly what the right choices are. So that's really the first piece. And then the other piece is, as we're doing that, I like to think about our friends in oncology and radiation. The reason why they know these answers so well is they set up studies. And we don't have enough of these patients, individual institutions to really do the study, but we certainly can do this in multi-center fashion. And so another piece that I think for the young academics out there listening, this is the way to create a career. You decide you're going to be, I'm just going to pick something, the malignant melanoma person. You get all your friends everywhere to collect their malignant melanomas, and then you set up multi-center studies to actually look at how things are going with that. And that's going to crack a nut on how to take care of these patients better and get some real answers for us. So that's really what I hope this document will inspire in some ways, be the start off for those larger multi-center big group studies.
Great. So as we near the end of this, is there anything that you think the general community of non-otolaryngologists that take care of these patients should know from this? What do you hope they would take from it?
Yeah, the most important thing is awareness of these tumors, awareness of how to identify really concerning signs. And then there's just growing interest in the field as a whole. Sinonasal tumors, as we talked about multiple times, is really rare. So there's a figure in the ICSNT, which actually showcases the explosion in research in this area within the last 20 years. We just use a simple PubMed query and you see that it's like exponentially increased over time when you use the same query over the last 20 years period. So as we elevate our game in both clinical care and research, I think we're going to need to put our heads together to push the frontier forward. And one of the biggest things I learned from this project, again, is that our oncology colleagues are so ahead of us in designing these projects, answering these questions, clinical research that's really meaningful that could directly impact patient care on a large scale. So we in otolaryngology really should follow that example, collaborate, and learn from them. That really has been the overarching message. It's a paradigm we follow in patient care. We always work together, multidisciplinary, to take care of patients, but we need to do that as well to understand how to best treat our patients.
Jim, is there anything else, anything you want to add?
Yeah, so if you're listening to this podcast, you made it this far, please do this for me as a favor to Palmer, if no one else. Use the QR code. Pull it up, and then put it in the files section of your cell phone. I've already done this multiple times in my clinic. You see a tumor, you pull it up on the files, you got 400 pages to go through. You don't want to go through 400 pages, but you do know want to know what the best thing is right now of what we know for, let's say, olfactory neuroblastoma. You can just real quick run your finger to that spot, and just like the encyclopedia, you can run to that section and real quick read it. Takes you a few minutes, and just like that, you are on the cutting edge. And that's why we designed this. And you've listened this far, so hopefully you're going to do it, because that's where we're. That's what really excites me about the whole thing. This gives us our chance to get everybody out beyond the same page to improve care across the board, or at least improve knowledge. And that really goes back, as you were saying, Mark, to the private practice crew. You know, you see somebody, you don't see these tumors every day, but if it's on your cell phone, you can be cogent, intelligent, understand what to do, the things to think of. Out right then and there. And I think that creates a lot of comfort as a practitioner to know that you're bringing that patient the best you can bring him.
And thanks, Ed, and thanks, Jim, for joining me. This has been a great discussion. And again, congratulations to you and your colleagues on your publication. And thank you, of course, to our Scope It Out listeners. This is Mark Dubin for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology, signing off for now.